What's up, Home Slices? This is part two of a two-part series where we review Scream. If you have not listened to part one, make sure you go wherever you're listening to this podcast and listen to part one. Okay? You've been warned.
Yeah. Speaking of, is she crazy? I'm thinking of like part of this story also as kind of a little bit like a psychological thriller, a little bit as far as like Sydney's kind of role, because just a few hours ago, she was going out on the porch, digging in her nose, talking about, oh, can you see me? And now she's cowering in the bathroom, right? Like, and you know, after the phone call she got when she was at Tatum's house, like there is a change that I'm seeing in her. Mm-hmm. And you know, the way she was, I would have been triggered if that was normal. I felt normal for her to be triggered by the guy coming down the hall in the costume. But then something weird happens to her while she's in the bathroom. She got down on that nasty floor after she heard someone whispering. And on the floor, she looks in the stalls and doesn't see any legs or anything, or, you know, and thinks she's there alone and that she just kind of tripping. And, you know, the girls have left by now. And after she hears the whispering again, she sees a man's boots climb down from a toilet in a stall. And he comes out. And of course, he is wearing, you know, a mask and he's dressed up as Ghostface. There is no knife. But Sydney, of course, is freaking the F out and she leaves the bathroom running and no one follows her. And for a split second, again, I like was thinking of this as a little bit of a psychological thriller. I was like, was that in her head? Like, for a split second, I was wondering if that was actually real and trying to figure out if it was a prankster or what in that moment. And later on, it's revealed again. At this point, I've never seen this movie, so I don't know what's happening. But yeah, we move on to a new scene. A reporter is sharing the Scream mask on the news, which is always a bad idea. And Gail is trying to get friendly with a 25-year-old Dewey. And I found her interactions with Dewey to be creepy and slightly predatory.
Okay.
Yes. I'm shocked that you didn't. I don't know. Again, because of the way that I see Dewey's character, it came across as quite creepy to me in this story. I don't know how old Courtney Cox's character is supposed to be, but something about the way she's talking to him and complimenting him while also infantilizing him at the same time, I find it like disgusting and creepy when men and women do it. But the way she was like, oh, but you're not 12 years old anymore, and I'm like, ew. I hated it.
Yeah.
But yeah, long story short, Dewey still can't get in touch with Sydney's dad. And
I think the beauty of Gail, like, yeah, it is creepy and it's super manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I ever saw this creepy before until like this recent conversation.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's manipulative based on her clout and popularity.
I absolutely see it as manipulative as well, because she is trying to get information out of him, right? He's a police officer. He has, and she is smarter than him, or she believes that she is smarter than him, so she can play him. And there's a power dynamic when it comes to at least their kind of level of intelligence.
Oh,
but there's also the flirting piece that is a part of the manipulation, but it comes off as almost predatory to me. And I think it was more so because of that power dynamic, but it just felt really yucky. I didn't care for it.
Well, this goes back to our earlier conversation about how we both saw Dewey and his developmental ability. Sorry, I'll let you continue, please.
Yeah, no worries. But again, Dewey can't get in touch with Sydney's dad, who is named Neil in the story. And so he hasn't been ruled out as a suspect. Dewey is appreciative of the flirting of Gail, and he kind of reciprocates it. And he also makes a weird comment about what's required to be considered a serial killer. So again, you know, I'm a side-eye Dewey again. And over the loudspeaker, Principal Winkler, and his real name in the movie, or real character's name, is Arthur Hembley, announces that classes are suspended and that the police have instated a 9 p.m. curfew. So things are getting heated up.
Yeah, a 9 p.m. curfew. I had that in my notes, too. Like, how quaint. Like, they're in California. Not that California is all L.A. or San Diego or, the big Southern California, San Francisco. But, like, I went to high school in a pretty small town. I can't imagine a citywide curfew. How would you even know about that? It just seems like, again, so quaint. I love it.
Yeah, I think it's... Well, of course, a curfew is being instated because they don't want more people getting killed.
For sure.
But back in Houston, when there was a big hurricane, they would, like, instate curfews as well. And we were living in a more suburban area, not rural like this was. But yeah, it was interesting to see. And we get like a little scene showing how the town has to adapt to this curfew. But yeah, I thought that was interesting because, you know, killers only kill after 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Always.
That's a rule, I guess. So class is out now. And so Tatum, Sydney, and Stuart walk together, you know, walking from school. And Sydney feels sure that the person in the bathroom was the actual killer. But Tatum is like, of course it was a prankster. Like, well, you already saw a prankster in the hallway earlier. And at this point, again, because I've never seen this movie, I am not sure. But again, I'm thinking of this as a psychological thriller a little bit from Sydney's standpoint, it would make sense for the killer to make her believe that she isn't safe anywhere, even at school. So again, at this point, it's up in the air as to who this actual person was. Stuart, who is excited that school is out, says he's throwing an intimate party at his house, and they convince Sydney to come, saying, you know, it'll be safe, you know, we'll all be there, it'll be safe, yeah, perfect. So yeah, then we get like a I wasn't expecting this scene. I wasn't expecting any of the scenes in the in the principal's office. We see the principal putting on the screen mask for a second, like a weirdo. And then he gets a couple of knocks on his office door, and he keeps looking for this person who keeps knocking on his door and leaving the area. So Principal Winkler goes out to the hallway outside of the main office, where he calls the culprit a little S-word under his breath, where he's overheard by a janitor. This janitor is dressed like Freddy Krueger and is even named Fred. And yes. It's clearly, you know, a joke and homage. And I found out in the fun fact that the janitor, well, not in the fun facts, it was actually the X-ray feature on Amazon Prime that alerted me to the fact that the janitor was being played by Wes Craven. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Who created the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise and also directed this movie, as well as the next three Scream sequels and a number of other, you know, very famous scary movies.
Yeah. No, that was one of my fun facts as well, is that I love when Principal Winkler goes out and then says, "Was that you, Fred?" And it's yes. Wes Craven dressed as Freddy Krueger is just top notch.
Yeah, so I was shocked by this. I didn't know that he was actually in the movie. And I'm like, well, it's cool when Wes Craven does it, but it's like annoying when M. Night Shyamalan does it. But anyways.
Is it though?
I find it annoying personally, but...
But that's like the Alfred Hitchcock thing. It's Alfred Hitchcock was in every one of his films. Yeah. It's a horror movie commonality between directors.
I see that. Again, I think because this movie is so self-referential, it's almost like Scary Movie without like the extra camp element. It's quite funny to me. I wasn't expecting to have like the humor in this movie. Again, because I have never seen this movie before. I expected it to be a little more serious. So I thought that was a really cute scene.
Yeah.
So when Principal Winkler returns to his office, he notices that some things in the room are different. His closet is closed, and he opens it quickly, only to be startled by his reflection in a mirror, right? And he's kind of freaking out a little bit, but when he turns around, Ghostface is hiding behind his office door and kills him with the knife. Was not expecting this. Because I low-key was like, is Henry Winkler? I shouldn't have suspected Henry Winkler as Ghostface because he's not tall enough. But I was not expecting for the principal to get killed. That was crazy.
Yeah, what I love about that, like even the boots on the ground or the height is they're all very masculine. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, it could be anybody. Like I think the size is hard to gauge based on the thing. I think our minds go to masculine, but realistically could be anybody besides Courtney Cox because she's freaking tiny.
It's quite interesting. I think the brutality of the crimes, I would always assume a masculine person. Not even what to do with the strength, just how brutal and gory everything is. I guess it could be a woman. I just would always think masculine when it comes to like the actual nature of the crimes. Yeah.
See, that goes back to the very first conversation at the fountain that the kids had. Mm-hmm. Is the killer had to be male. The killer could easily be female, right? Like,
in my opinion, I can't envision a lady doing this. Just personally.
I have thoughts. I think it's going to be a much deeper conversation than we have time for.
If it was two ladies, maybe. One lady? No. Mm-mm. Yeah, I don't know. You know,
but what makes you think it's going to be one man?
Because they're pretty strong. Because the guys asked about like having to hoist a person on Casey was hang. I don't see a lady doing that.
Leverage. It's an amazing thing.
And yeah, again, dragging her across the field.
Deeper. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. Dragging him across the field.
Yeah.
Yeah, again. Much deeper conversation.
We switch the scene and we hear School's Out by Alice Cooper playing in the background because, of course, School's Out. And we switch scenes over to an unknown house. I don't know whose house this is. And I'm like, where are the parents? Where are Stu's parents? People are getting murdered in this town. Where are the parents? Anyways, Tatum has a talk with Sydney on the front porch of this unknown house, and she wonders if there was actually any truth to Cotton's affair with Maureen. Tatum says that Sydney's dad was like always out of town, and there were like multiple ongoing rumors of Maureen sleeping around. Now, Sydney clearly doesn't want to believe that those stories are true and knows that Cotton couldn't prove an affair in court. But Sydney starts doubting that she accused the right man. And Tatum, despite just suggesting that Cotton was right, says that Sydney shouldn't think like a Wes Carpenter film, which is hilarious.
So good.
I was like, okay, another self-referential moment. It was very funny to me. But in the distance, we see Ghostface in the bushes. So we know.
I hate that.
Why? Why do you hate Ghostface in the bushes?
So it happens again in a future scene that's about to come up, but it seems like this is more self-referential kitschy, and that just seems like, what are the chances of, like, dude hanging out as Ghostface in the bushes? Like, when you know who the killers are, why wouldn't you just, like, one of the dudes being like, oh, I'm just creeping. It's cool. Like, it's weird. Or one of the ladies, right? Like, it's weird.
Yeah, just lurking.
It's so odd. Yeah. Yeah. And like in the summer heat, they're clearly not cold. Like it seems like they're going to be covered in sweat. It's weird.
Yeah. Like, I could see that. Well, we're at the video store now. In a new scene, Randy is working there and Stuart comes to visit him. Billy is also there talking to some girls in the horror section. Weird. Randy feels that Billy is a murderer and is using movie logic quite loudly in this video store to talk about why there's always a reason to kill your girlfriend. Randy actually likes Sydney and is hoping that this fiasco will break Billy and Sydney up so he can have a chance at her. When Stuart accuses Sydney's dad of being the culprit, Randy uses more movie logic to loudly say that Sydney's dad is probably dead already and will probably pop up in the final frame mutilated. Everybody's a suspect. And then he turns around and runs into Billy right when he accuses Billy, and they have like a little bit of a confrontation. What do you think about this scene? Again, I don't know how to feel about Jamie Kennedy, but I actually really enjoyed this scene as like this purposely self-referential, self-aware moment.
Again, I love Jamie Kennedy for this movie. It's like, it's so good. Everything about the movie theater, everything about the gal behind him with like side-eyeing, be like, what are you talking about? Matthew Lillard, Stu, like being like, quiet down, man, is incredible. And the way he backs down to Billy, which we may be getting to, is really, really interesting. Because he's a guy who's clearly been picked on and has a lot of thoughts and then immediately takes back his thoughts. It's an amazing scene. This movie's so good. I love it.
I mean, yeah, if I thought you were a murderer, I would take back everything. Personally. Yeah,
exactly. Right? Like, everybody, like, he's so passionate about what he does. Like,
yeah.
So I'll correlate myself into this a little bit. Like, so passionate about what he does. So passionate about this movie that nobody's seen for 20, 30 years.
Right.
Like, I love it. Everybody's a suspect. Oh, no, I'm scared.
Yeah.
So good.
I really enjoyed that scene in particular. But we get like a little tiny little montage of people going home and businesses closing down for the curfew. So we see that these murders are affecting the entire town, right? Dewey takes Sydney and Tatum to the grocery store because they were assigned to get the food for the party. In front of the grocery store, Sydney says that if there were some movie about her life, she bet that Tori Spelling would be cast as her. Which is a little funny because Tori Spelling is in Scary Movie 2.
Yes. As Sydney Prescott.
Yes. That's quite funny and quite hilarious. I don't know the whole history of Tori Spelling, and I don't know why, like, in 1996, it's funny that she said, with my luck, I would get Tori Spelling. I don't know why that's funny. But right now in 2024, it's funny. So, yeah, at the store, Tatum and Sydney shop, and they talk about Sydney's sexual issues and how it's impacted her relationship. Tatum says Billy doesn't deserve her. I agree. And we see Ghostface reflection in the store. He's there, lurking, again.
Yeah, I hate it.
Now that I'm thinking about it, if I'm still thinking of this as a psychological thriller, I'm trying to figure out if he's hoping she'll get a glimpse of him. And think that she's kind of going crazy. But she never seems to actually notice him. It seems like they're playing it up more for us than for Sydney herself. But yeah, while the girls are shopping, Dewey chats with the sheriff. He's eating an ice cream cone while the
sheriff is... Favorite scenes in the entire movie. I love the scene.
The sheriff's smoking a cigarette, but Dewey is eating an ice cream cone, and we find out that the calls were traced to Sydney's father's cell phone when they cross-referenced, you know, Casey's calls and Sydney's calls. So Dewey says something weird about the cell phone being cloned, but then the sheriff kind of ignores that comment. He says that they'll try to find Neil, Sydney's father, and will even go house to house if they can't find him. The sheriff also instructs Dewey to not let Sydney out of his sight. So, again, we're getting some additional kind of hints about who the killer maybe possibly could be. And at this point in the story, for me, Dewey is like my number one suspect. I found him to be quite suspicious. Do you have something about that scene?
Did ya?
Yes.
Basically.
I didn't stop suspecting Dewey till way later. So, at this point, I'm thinking it's Dewey.
Okay. All that. I love that scene, though. I think it's one of the best, like, cinematic scenes in my recent memory. It's so well shot.
Yes, it was a really good scene. The ice cream was funny. Again, that's, yeah, saying more about Dewey's character, right? But next up, Dewey drops off the girls at Stewart's house, which is huge. Stewart's house is so big. These kids are rich, okay? Also, Gail's news van follows them there. So Dewey ends up scaring Gail. When he approaches the van and they decide to go in and check out the party together. Of course, Gail brings a handheld camera, right? So she can get the scoop. So the kids at the party seem excited to see Gail. I guess she's kind of a celebrity. And While Sydney is talking to Dewey, Gail sets up her camera inside an entertainment center facing the living room. The kids kind of talk a little bit about movies. I didn't take a whole bunch of notes on that part, but at some point, she is sent to the garage to get some more beers out of the refrigerator. And so she goes into the garage. It has a malfunctioning garage door. And she's grabbing some more beers. And while she's in there, she gets trapped in the garage by Ghostface. And she kind of mostly thinks it's a joke. And it's kind of like, oh, what are you going to do? Like, until the knife comes out. And so, of course, they get into a fight because she realizes she's actually in danger. And she fights pretty hard. Again, I love that the people in this movie are actually, like, fighting back, even if it is booping somebody with a phone. But she hits the killer with the freezer door. She's throwing beers at him. She is, like I said, putting up a fight. And she is ultimately killed when she tries to escape through a pet door that's on the garage door. And interestingly enough, when she gets stuck inside of this door, the garage door starts working all of a sudden and ends up crushing Tatum. What do you think about this scene, Beth? Am I tripping? Because the whole point was that the garage door wouldn't lift up all the way. But when Tatum is in there, now it's lifting up all the way. Am I tripping?
I think so. I don't think the garage door is not lifting up all the way. I think that she tries to lift it up and then he's hitting the stop button every time he's
there. I didn't even think about that. I thought it was malfunctioning.
When she looks back, he's there, which I did not get because I just recently got a garage myself and never had a garage when I was younger. So never entered that in my mind, and not saying anybody else didn't either, but like I didn't understand. And that's happened a couple times to me. So I think it was when she was like trying to go out, he was stopping it himself.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I think he was stopping the door. The door wasn't working. Okay. Yes.
No. And then when the door was working to Tatum's demise was when he's like let it go, which is a whole other physics conversation of how heavy do you think she is? About 130 pounds? Could that lift up? Fun fact real quick is on the set of the movie, multiple people tried to fit out of that pet door, as you called it, to see if they actually could fit out of it. And if you notice in the movie, on one scene, her shoulder is all the way out. On the other scene, her shoulder is in. They like actually did quite a few takes of this to see if it was actually possible. With Rose McGowan's stature, it was. So it's kind of interesting. Also, with most garage doors, that would not be possible to lift up a person of 120 to 140 pounds.
I agree. But this particular kill scene, I love a good creative kill scene. And it's, you know, as opposed to some of the other ones we've seen in this film that is just like, hey, we're stabbing. This one is the most creative and I dig it. Okay.
I also like the build up to it, right? Like even like you touched on a little bit of her kind of taunting the killer a little bit. Mm-hmm. She knows it's him kind of way. But the, again, play on the, we know this is a movie of, I think her exact line is, "Hey, Mr. Ghostface, are you going to kill me? Am I going to be in the sequel?" Like, she plays on the movie trope, which I think is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And then she fights back, almost like Jackie Chan style, with the door and the bottles. Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing. And yes, she does die. It's like, pour one out for Rose McGowan. But
yes, yeah, it's great. I really enjoyed this particular scene. Probably my favorite kill scene in the movie. Immediately after the kill scene, I saw some kids going home. But them finding out about the principal happens a little bit later. Because I was like, there's some kids leaving the party, but still a lot of kids there. I don't know what was going on at the moment, but you could see kids leaving the house.
Mm. Yes, those kids are good kids who are going home for curfew.
Yes. So at this point, Sydney is looking for Tatum when Billy pops up wanting to talk to Sydney alone. And Stuart is like, you can go to my parents' room, which is weird. And Randy is pissed that he's not going to get his chance with Sydney and decides to eavesdrop on the couple. He says he's going to, but there's no indication that he actually did. But in the meantime, Gail and her cameraman use the planted camera to live stream the party with a 30-second delay. So they're able to see what's going on in the house. Gail is like, I'm going to be up for a Pulitzer. Like, this is going to be amazing, right? She's still super focused on her career in this moment. So back at the house, Sydney and Billy talk in private, and Sydney decides that she needs to get out of the grieving process and being in denial about her mom's promiscuity. She was really preoccupied with thinking that she would turn out to be like her mother. And then they talk about like this being like a movie. And again, the movie is super self-referential and I actually really love it. But basically they're like, you know, life is a movie and you don't get to decide what genre. And it's like, it's very like tragic and teenager, like tragic teenager mm-hmm. talk. Mm-hmm. But basically they both apologize to each other and they make out. And Sydney's like, I'm ready. And Billy, of course, is down in Stuart's parents' bed like some freaking weirdos. But downstairs, the kids are watching Halloween pretty loudly, and Randy, who is a movie buff, goes into a monologue about what it takes to survive a horror movie. Number one, don't have sex. What's going on upstairs? We already know. Number two, don't drink or do drugs. Everybody in that room is drinking or doing drugs. And then
what's they're all aware of?
Yes. And number three, don't say I'll be right back. And of course, Stuart leaves the room and says he'll be right back. And Randy makes a comment that he'll see Stuart in the kitchen with the knife. So then I was like, well, damn, is Randy the killer? I'm again realizing that, like, I don't know what's happening in this movie. So who is the killer? Who knows? But right then, Dewey asks Gail to accompany him down the road where he's been called to examine a car that's in the bushes. They take a walk. And so we get a few kind of parallel scenes that are all happening at the same time, right? We got the kids mm-hmm. watching Halloween while, you know, Sydney is upstairs being deflowered by Billy. And then we get Dewey and Gail, right? And so suddenly there's a phone call to Stuart's house and Randy answers and ends up sharing with the other teens in the house that Principal Henry Winkler was found dead, gutted, and hanging from the goalposts on the football field. That's crazy. And in a weird twist, again, I wasn't expecting this, all the teens except Randy head over to the football field to see. They want to see the principal. And I'm like, why?
Can actually, I have something to add to this with the writers, because these kids are terrible, clearly.
Yes.
So Principal Winkler was also kind of creepy, so that could be why. I actually don't know why. But the only reason he was killed was so all of these kids would leave the house, which I think is interesting. So like, if you see everybody, Max, exodus mm-hmm. of the party house, it's just to see him hanging up from the football field, which again, is weird.
That's weird. That's so weird to me.
It also makes me question, like, how weird was the principal? Like, they all want to see him dead? Or are these kids terrible?
I didn't think about it from that end of, like, the kids hate him so much that they want to see him disemboweled.
Or it's also, like, the 90s where the whole trope of violence doesn't matter, which to some extent is true. Like, I think this movie's hilarious, so it's, like, exhibit A. But it's a weird thing for kids to, like, go out and see. But also, who called that in? Like, who said, mm-hmm. Principal Winkler is strung up? Like, who did that? Who made that call? It's weird.
That is a weird call.
But that was the reason for it, for the movie, mm-hmm. was to get all the kids out of the house.
It makes sense to me. But yeah, what doesn't make sense to me is I don't know if it's like small town syndrome. Like if anything's happening, let's all go and see it because they don't have like a lot of stuff going on. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I was just like, who wants to go see that? Anyways, that was very strange to me. But Dewey and Gale are walking on the road and we learn Dewey's real name is actually Dwight. And Gale talks about, you know, how she has a stage name too. And they're, you know, getting a little buddy buddy, whatever. And then they end up getting run off the road by the drunk driving teenagers. And Dewey falls on top of Gale and they make out a little bit. But then Gale spots a car in the bushes, which happens to be Neil's car, who, you know, Sydney's dad. And so Dewey is freaking out and he's like, what is Neil doing here? And he's like, we got to get back to the house because, of course, they're thinking Neil is going to strike again since he is the primary suspect in all these murders, right? And so we flip the scene back to the recently deflowered Sydney, and she and Billy are getting dressed. And so Sydney starts asking questions about Billy's one phone call when he got arrested. I was like, girl, where is this going? She's a smart cookie because she's trying to figure out if he called her at Tatum's house to throw her off. And when he asks, what do I have to do to prove I'm not the killer? Behind him, Ghostface comes in and stabs and kills Billy in front of a very stunned Sydney. And she manages to escape. And of course, she's running around the house and they do the whole cat and mouse thing until Sydney kind of uses what appears to be something like an attic to climb out of a window. And she ends up falling off of the roof. She falls off the roof. Thankfully, she lands on a covered boat that cushions her fall. And I'm like,
oh,
that's tragically lucky.
That's also not how the covers of boats work. She probably would.
Because I'm thinking, like, if the boat has seats, she could have, like.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yes. It was like a little trampoline was underneath that cover or something. I don't know. She kind of bounces off of it, but she gets really lucky. And I was like, you know, I'll give him a pass on this one, okay? But when she gets her bearings, she is in front of the garage and she sees that Tatum is dead and kind of hanging from the little pet door. So now, of course, she's extra freaked out, right? Well, next up, we see Randy, who's watching Halloween alone because everyone left. And he's talking to the screen as Ghostface is behind him preparing to murder him. Now, what's funny is to me, well, I'm sure it's funny to other people, is that Randy keeps saying, turn around, Jamie, because he's instructing Jamie Lee Curtis's character to turn around because, you know, Mike Myers is behind her. But his name is Jamie. It's funny. That's Jamie pretty Candy, good.
Yeah. It's, yes. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good.
That was great. But before Ghostface can kill Randy, Sydney screams for help because she's running through the fields or whatever and distracts him. So she runs to the news van that she spotted when she was up in the attic. And so she and Gale's cameraman are watching on the screen from like the live stream that Ghostface is approaching Randy with a knife. And so when the cameraman hops out so he can like try to help, and he sees that the front door is open and he remembers that there's a 30-second delay between what, you know, is real and what happens on that screen. And so when he turns back around, his throat is slit by Ghostface. Of course, Sydney is freaking out. And, you know, she slams the van door, but not before Ghostface stabs Sydney in, like, the chest and, like, the upper, like, clavicle area. And so she slams the van door. She escapes out of the back of the van. And I was like, why was the back door open? I don't know what was going on with the van. But anyway, Sydney runs back towards the house. So things are heating up. We got, like, a good chase scene going at this point.
But why is he chasing her through the van? Like, why not just run around?
That's a great point.
Small nitpick.
Yes. Well, then next up, we see Gale and Dewey. And this is the point where I was like, okay, Dewey can't be the killer because he's just pulling up with Gale. This is the point where I'm like, okay, it's not Dewey. So again, it's almost the end of the movie. And I'm like, okay, it's not him. Okay. But Dewey instructs Gale to go to the van and call for backup because there's a phone in the van. So Dewey comes into the house calling for Neil. And you can tell that he's very nervous about what he's going to find. And I'm like, well, damn. I thought he was a murderer. I don't know what to expect at this point. But when Gale gets to the van, she finds blood and no Kenny. Kenny is the cameraman. So when she hops into the van, she tries to call the police and she gets startled by Randy. And so she boops Randy with the phone a few times. So this is the second person who's gotten booped with the phone. And so Randy falls to the ground. So she uses her windshield wipers because there's something weird on the windows and it's blood. And so she's freaking out and she decides to drive away. And because of like the inertia, Kenny's dead body falls onto the windshield. This, again, another reason why I don't think this could be a lady killer, because who's throwing that big man on top of a van?
Okay, but what small man of any of these, any of the dudes that we've seen, we know it's one of them. Could be, like, I would put my weight behind Sydney as much as I would Stu.
Like, no way! Stu's way bigger than her.
Bigger is not equal stronger.
Like, if you think a man versus like, a woman?
Yeah, no. I'll argue this point. Okay. So, I'll argue this point. Stu lifting that dude up versus Sydney lifting that dude up, she looks way stronger than he does.
You think Sydney looks way stronger than Stu?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Which, again, we can debate. Okay. I don't think either one of them could. I don't think anybody without some pulley systems, like, no offense to that actor, did a great job. That's a big dude. Like, I don't think any single person's going to lift that guy up on a van of that size.
Yeah. Well,
male or female.
Makes sense to me. I don't know. But Kenny's dead body falls on the windshield. So she's freaking out because she's trying to drive away. Gail is able to kind of, you know, drive around enough to get Kenny's body to fall off of the van. And so she's trying to head out and Sydney kind of jumps in front of the van, flagging her down. But Gail gets startled by this and she overcorrects to avoid hitting Sydney. And she ends up crashing into like a nearby ravine. And so Sydney, you know, calls for Dewey and she's walking up to the house and Dewey pops out of the house in like the main entrance. And then he ends up collapsing with a knife in his back. And I was like, well, dang, it really wasn't Dewey. And so suddenly Ghostface appears in the doorway up behind Dewey and he grabs a knife out of Dewey's back as Sydney, you know, heads to the police cruiser to escape. She locks the door and, you know, rolls up the window to find that Ghostface has the keys. He's kind of showing her the keys from outside of the car. He unlocks some of the doors and kind of does his disappearing act. And again, very kind of psychological to me, like playing this game with her like a, you know, cat and mouse. And so, you know, he unlocks some of the doors and then the trunk hatch. And so she tries to use the police, the police radio. And he hops into the back of the truck and attacks her from behind. And she manages to get away. She is slippery. She has gotten away from this killer multiple times in this movie. And then when she gets away from him, she loses track of him so fast.
But I also think like using the CB radio to call is very similar to like what she did earlier, which like, any means necessary, I'll call for help, which is kind of commendable.
Yeah, it's resourceful.
Like, she has her wits about her.
It's quite resourceful, yes. But suddenly, you know, she's running towards the front of the house, and Randy and Stuart both approach Sydney, and Sydney has grabbed Dewey's gun because Dewey is kind of like unconscious on the front porch. And so Sydney is like, you know, talking to Randy and Stu, and they're both kind of accusing each other of being the killer. And each one of them kind of want the gun to shoot the other one for killing all their friends and for killing Tatum. And Sydney, of course, is confused. And she's like, F both of you. And she closes the front door on both of them. Which I thought was funny. I don't know why that was funny to me.
So good. No, it's so good.
It's like, screw you both. Y'all. One of y'all kill the other one out here and I'll know who the killer is for real. But suddenly, again, wasn't expecting this, Billy wakes up and falls down the stairs. So he is alive, but appears to be bleeding out, right? And so Billy takes the gun from her. And he ends up letting, kind of calming her down. He's like, yeah, everything's okay. Come on, like, whatever. And so he lets Randy into the house and he proceeds to shoot Randy in the chest. And I was like, what? Again, I've never seen this movie before. I wasn't expecting that. Something weird happened. Beth, I don't know if you're going to know what I'm talking about. But when Billy lifted the gun to shoot Randy, his arm looked fake. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. I don't know if it's like a weird lens or the trick of the light or if I'm tripping, but something about his arm looked distorted or bent or like, I don't know what it was. I was like, what is wrong with his arm? It looked fake.
No, I've been watching everything as we've been recording. I don't know if it does. Does it? It looks weird. It does look weird.
Yeah. I don't know what was going on with his arm.
It looks like action star just probably dislocated. Well, that's weird. Yes.
But he was an action star. Like Harry Potter when he didn't have bones.
But then he can hold the gun.
It was weird. I don't know how to describe it. I literally had to rewind it and I was like, what is happening with his arm? I don't know. It could just be a me thing. But anyways, of course, Sydney is stunned by this twist, as am I, because I didn't know who the killer was. But Billy reveals that he is covered in corn syrup and not blood, just like the movies. And when Stu comes in, he uses a voice box to mimic the voice of the caller. And so we realize in this moment, or I realize in this moment, you knew this already, that Billy and Stu are in cahoots and they are both Ghostface. Right. Is there any part of you that can go back to the first time you watched this and realizing who the killers were?
No, because I'm old at this point. But also, two killers. You didn't see that coming, right? Mm-hmm. It was a one-time thing. Ever happened. And what happens next is so interesting, of the whys behind it all.
Yeah. Yeah. The fact that there were two killers was surprising to me. I think also the fact that presumably Billy had been kind of exonerated multiple times. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wasn't expecting Billy to be the killer either. So we find out that they are kind of like psychotic teens who managed to frame Cotton, and they even killed Sydney's mom. And I was like, what? Like, what? And of course, the motive, right? We want to know, like, you know, Sydney is like, why? Like, why are y'all doing all of this? And they're like, oh, there's no motive. And we did her a favor by killing her, whatever. And eventually, Billy says the real motive, that Maureen was sleeping with his dad. And Maureen's the reason that his mom left him. And I was like, why did he just say that? He has mommy issues. Like, you know, that's Norman Bates. You know, it's common. Mm-hmm. All the psychotic killers have mommy issues.
But he kind of did earlier. I think that's kind of like ties the tie my mom left town. Why can't you get over it? Mm-hmm. Like all those conversations are so interesting when you see it in hindsight. Mm-hmm. Of like he is so just hung up on this one thing. And
yeah.
I understand it's going to be hard. But don't really kill anybody about it. Or frame people for murder.
Yeah. The lengths that they went to is freaking crazy.
Mm-hmm. Especially for 17-year-olds.
Yes. They killed a lady. You're dating the lady's daughter.
Yeah. Four before that. Like, he killed her while he was dating her. That's next level.
Right. And then they frame someone who's on freaking death row. Mm-hmm. They go on another killing spree a year later and kill quite a few more people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're playing the long game. That's crazy to me.
I think the long game's the crazy part to me.
Yes.
Like, these boys are probably insane. Like, clearly are insane. The fact that they kill one person, and if they are actually sociopathic or psychopathic, wait a year. But there's also a lot of planning involved on how to execute. Nope. Pun intended, sounds like terrible. How to execute the next level. Oh, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's crazy. But look, now that Sydney is deflowered, it's time for her to die because that's what happens, right, in the scary movies. Mm-hmm. So Stu's weird behind says that they have a surprise for Sydney, and he enthusiastically grabs a beat up and tied up Neil, who they plan to frame for all the murders due to his stress at the anniversary of his wife's murder. So yeah, they even go so far as to frame Neil, another part of their elaborate plan.
So much planning. It's incredible.
Yeah. Teenage boys don't plan nothing. But these... They don't even wash their underwear so they can have clean underwear. But these kids have like a year-long plan to get Sydney to give up the drawers so they can execute this plan. What the heck? That part feels like a big part of this plan, which is crazy. But Billy and Stu are in the plan, are supposed to get away scot-free, looking like the lone survivors of like a crazy like murder spree, right? And so Stu and Billy in this weird scene enthusiastically stab each other. So it's convincing that they are survivors. But Billy's crazy behind keeps stabbing Stu over and over again and giving orders. What do you think about the dynamic between Stu and Billy? Because in this scene, it reaches a different height. Like, we knew that they were clearly friends and had a dynamic, but this particular dynamic when they were doing their, you know, villain thing and it's the big reveal, their dynamic is like just heightened. What do you think about it?
I'm so glad you asked that, because when I was like, ooh, is when I was about to chime in, and you're going to get there. I think it's so interesting, A, because Billy is clearly the mastermind of all of it. He orchestrated, yeah, the majority of it, with Stu doing bits and pieces here and there. If we think of the Gilmans themselves and think of how, like, even back at the beginning with Casey Becker and Stu Mark, Casey stomped Stu for Steve. Stu took revenge. Like, mm-hmm. I've thought about this a lot over the years, which is probably a sad thing to say. But every killing has a purpose in their minds, in, like, an adolescent male's minds, mm-hmm. which is really interesting to consider and also really, really sad. But I think Stu's main motivator is his friend. It's doing what his friend wants, which we'll get into in the next couple scenes.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you're saying. I think that Billy's dynamic with Stu comes across as abusive. And it's another kind of trope for me a little bit, where, like, there's a mastermind and then there's, I may describe them as like an imp, maybe, or like
a henchman.
A henchman, right? And so yeah. Stu comes across as more of a henchman, but their relationship comes across as quite abusive. Like mm-hmm. the fact that Billy is just kind of over enthusiastically continuing to stab Stu, which maybe didn't feel like part of the plan.
So the second part was clearly Billy wanted to kill Stu. He wanted to be a social survivor. Like, there was no other. An argument could be made that he was just heightened. But I think at this point in the movie, Billy is going to kill Stu. He wanted to be the sole survivor. He wanted to be the final girl.
I actually didn't think about that. Again, this is my first time seeing the movie, but you're probably right. Yeah. But yeah, Billy says a weird line about movies making psychos more creative.
That's the, like, best line.
People don't go crazy because of, or people aren't psychotic because they're watching movies, but then I guess the movies just, you know, bring out the psycho's imagination. Stu tries to find the gun, right? And it's missing. And Stu was like, hey, where's the gun? He's also bleeding out. So he's also kind of dying. And he's like, I'm pretty sure I put it here. But come to find out, Gail has the gun. And she does a little monologue about saving the day. But Billy, of course, isn't afraid of her because he sees something that she doesn't know. And when she tries to shoot the gun, it does not work because she has a safety on, which allows Billy to kick her through the door. She flew some feet.
She's very small.
She flew out of the door and fell onto Dewey. And so she is indisposed right now, right? And she's unconscious. And so Stu and Billy are preparing to execute Gail. Shoot her in the head. But then Stu realizes that some time has gone by and Sydney and her dad are gone. And they end up getting a call from Sydney, who uses the voice box to inform them that she has called the police and reported them already. Again, she's good at calling the police. She might be like the OG Karen. But oh.
Okay, but like for a valuable purpose?
Wait, what?
For, like, a purpose? Like, she's the OG Karen for...
She called the police for a rightful purpose. A reason? So maybe not a Karen. Yes, but Stu at this point has been stabbed so badly that he's kind of losing his strength and can't really help Billy find where Sydney and her dad went. So Billy gets the phone to Stu so they can keep, you know, talking while he goes to kind of look for them. So Sydney, of course, starts to play her own little game, right? So she's like, you know, what was your motive? I know why Billy, the mama's boy, was, you know, doing all this, but what was your motive? And like you said earlier, his motive was peer pressure. And that is crazy. I don't know that any of my friends could get me to do anything like this. Mm-hmm. My friends can barely get me out the house.
As your friend? Same.
Yes. So it's crazy that a friend could be like, hey, I'm going to go on a year-long killing spree. That is crazy. Anyway, but in this moment, I love this part because they go from being psycho killers who had it all figured out and had this super tight plan to scared teens who don't know what they're getting into. And so we see the power dynamic switch and we see both of them kind of losing it, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually love seeing the tables turn in this way. Stu is crying and he's being a little baby, talking about how mad his parents will be at him.
I love that. I love that scene so much.
Yeah, again, I just love seeing that they went from having it all figured out to freaking out because things weren't going according to plan, right? And so Billy is in the living room ripping up couch cushions because Sydney and her dad are pocket change. I don't know. He's just mad. And Billy hears a noise coming from like a closet or whatever. And Sydney, who is dressed in the Ghostface costume, pops out of the door and kind of stabs him with an umbrella. And I'm like, what? But, you know, use what you got to use. She's resourceful, okay? And so that kind of indisposes him for a little bit. Dying Stu tackles her after she gets out of the costume. And I'm like, girl, why did you put the costume on? Why did she put the costume on?
I have so many thoughts about, like, everything you're saying right now. But yes, because if a cop walked in right now, not going to look good. Not going to be good in your defense. Or why you just killed two dudes. An entire household.
She didn't have to put on the costume.
And there was no theatrics behind it, right? Like, no reason to.
Yeah, none. Because we know who the killer is now, so it's not like we're... I don't know why she put on the costume. It was stupid. I could see there being some merit to, like, because now she has the upper hand. Mm-hmm. She is now the killer and is wanting to play mm-hmm. this game where, you know, she has the power now and she is Ghostface. But mm-hmm. right now, you are in danger. It's not the time to play dress up. It doesn't make sense.
Okay, so we were 100% going to this exact same place, and I love that. Yeah, it seems like a lot of effort. Like, how did she even get the costume in the closet? Like, she had to plan that a little bit.
That's true.
Like, a tiny little bit.
Maybe it was already down there?
Probably, but she had to, like, get in the closet with her dad. She had to drag her dad into the closet and be like, I'm also going to take this.
For whatever reason, I feel like it wasn't just a closet, that it might have been a basement or something. Either way.
Yeah. Like, drag your dad into, like, a dark, weird place. That's extra weird. And then also go back and get a costume?
Yeah.
Seems odd.
Mm-mm. No, it'll make no sense.
The other thing with this is, I'm going to go back a couple scenes. I love the scene between Billy and Stu. I think it is phenomenal on how fragile their actual relationship is.
Mm-hmm.
Also, back to the very beginning of my comments on all ad-libs and improv, Matthew Lillard just did most of that scene by himself. And if you haven't seen the movie, please watch it just for that last scene again, because it's phenomenal. To the point where there's one scene where they're talking to Sydney, as Kiera said, like, she's really, really angry, and so it throws the phone and it hits him in the head because it's like the corn syrup stuck to his hand.
Mm-hmm.
He throws it, and she's like, you hit me with the phone, dick. Like, it was all improv. That was not supposed to happen in the actual film. Like, so much of that last scene is just incredible improv, and mm-hmm. nobody thought this movie was going to do well, and it revitalized horror.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a good point. Just the energy in that scene, you can just feel these two kind of psychotic kids feeding off of each other.
It's terrifying.
You know, one is more so like the host, where the other one is kind of like a parasite. But mm-hmm. just their energy in the scene and Stu's over-the-topness and how loud he is and how animated mm-hmm. he is.
But also, like, how careful, like, when he answers the phone and crosses his legs. I watched the movie way too many times, sorry. Like, when he answers the phone and crosses his legs and says, hello. Like, it's so, like, docile. And, like, mm-hmm. he's clearly, to your point earlier, like, he grew up in a probably wealthy household. Where he did things in a more proper manner. I think that is also overly interesting. Like, the fact that he crosses his legs, I think, is interesting.
It's funny. I didn't notice that.
It's because you thought you were watching a scary movie. No judgment.
But yes, so when she's taking off the costume, Stu, you know, right after she gets it on, Stu tackles her, and Sydney and Stu are kind of wrestling. You know, Sydney's fighting for her life. She gets the best of him a little bit because he's dying, right? And so this kill scene was stupid. She throws the TV on top of Stu and he dies from electrocution.
I love it.
What the hell?
It's so campy. It's so campy.
That was stupid. I was like, mm-mm. The rest of the kill scenes made a little bit of sense. I believe the garage thing before I believe this.
I loved it.
But yeah, so he's dead, right? And so Sydney's dumb butt goes to where the knocked out Billy is laying, and then Randy pops up out of nowhere, a little jump scare, happy to be a virgin, right? And so at this point, Billy wakes up, punches Randy, and climbs over Sydney to strangle her as he says, say hello to your mother. And so Sydney puts her finger in Billy's umbrella wound. And when he winces in pain, Gail, who is alive, shoots him in the shoulder. And it's like, I didn't forget the safety that time. And so Sydney takes the gun and they go over to see if Billy is alive. And Randy warns them that the killer comes back to life around this time.
And what does she say? What does she say?
Wait, what?
What does she say? Well,
what does who say? Sydney? Not yet. Billy pops up and Sydney shoots him in the head saying, not in my movie.
Not in my movie. Oh, so good. Sorry.
Yeah, that was great. And so we get one final scare when Neil pops up out of the room and we're like, oh yeah, we forgot about you, which is exactly what Randy said earlier was going to happen with the dad. Mm-hmm. Kind of coming up at the end.
Pop
so,
up the last reel.
Right. So the movie closes with Neil being taken to the hospital and Gail reporting on her eyewitness account. She has earned this story personally. She almost died. So I am mad at her on that one. And then we get like a little flash of Ghostface right before the credits roll. That's the end of the movie, y'all. Any thoughts on the final scene?
I have so many thoughts on the thing. The scene's amazing. I think the final scene, the boom shot going up on the house is really, really great. So Wes Craven pitched this was meant to be a trilogy. It was always meant to be a trilogy. That's how it was pitched. It's how it's supposed to be. The Scream 2 and Scream 3, like them or hate them, I'll take it. I love the trilogy. And then they came out with more and more and more. So I think because of the fact that it was pitched a trilogy, the Scream mask coming up at the end was probably a hint to this is not over, even though both the killers are dead, right? It's an interesting concept for sure.
Yeah. And we also always get like copycats and stuff. So I think it would make sense for the series to continue. So that's a good point. So yeah, y'all, that's the end of Scream. And at the end of every review, we answer two questions. Is the movie worth a rewatch? And does the movie hold up today? Beth, what do you think?
If you listen to the entire episode, then I would say yes to both, obviously. It's one of my favorites because I think it revitalized the horror movie genre and slasher, especially genre. And it's worth a rewatch because it is equally hilarious and interesting. It was weird to say for a slasher.
Yeah, it's a good point. Did you already say if it held up for you? Because I...
Oh, I said both. Yeah, held up.
Okay, great. Yes,
and it's worth a rewatch. But here, what do you think?
So, I feel like the movie is definitely worth a rewatch. Again, like I said, I was going through this film. I realized I've never seen it. So, and then I had gotten the ending of this movie mixed up with the end of Scary Movie. So, I spent most of the movie thinking Dewey was the killer. So, this was actually the first time I've seen it all the way through. I was pleasantly surprised and got to watch it with fresh eyes. So, I feel like this movie is definitely worth a rewatch. While parts of it were like very 90s, like how the technology has changed and a number of these things could like never happen today, I feel like it hasn't aged poorly, despite some of those kind of like very 90s things. And so that brings me to my verdict on if it holds up. The answer for me is mostly yes. Now, there are a few elements of the story that I kind of don't care for. The questionable kind of mental capabilities of David Arquette's character, Dewey. I can't tell if he's supposed to be portraying someone who might have special needs, and that probably won't be okay in 2024. And, you know, there are a number of creepy things that happen, like Principal Winkler. Mm-hmm. He was creepy and weird. And I also didn't like the way that Gail was interacting with Dewey. I found that to be a little predatory as well. I don't think those things necessarily hold up today. But some of the things, particularly the kind of like sexist contrast that's drawn between, you know, the blonde bimbo and the prudish brunette, because of how self-referential the story was, it makes sense. And it's like on the nose and it's satire. Typically, I would be like, oh, this is a trope. We need to get rid of it or whatever. But because they talk about it and are very self-aware, I totally get it. And it feels more okay in this movie. I like how the story breaks the fourth wall. I wasn't expecting that, and how it talks about itself in other scary movies. I don't like that all the kids are too old to be in high school. They look, almost all of them were old enough to have graduated college. So I don't like the 25-year-old teenager, personally. But essentially, that's it. I think those are the only kind of things and elements that make this story kind of not hold up today. But none of them are like too bad where it's like, don't watch this movie. I do like that all the people in the movie who got attacked put up a really good fight. It wasn't easy for Ghostface. And mm-hmm. I find that some of that lends itself to the fact that Ghostface in this movie are like teenagers. They're like a little bumbling, like a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. And the story has a lot of people who went on to have great careers. And like the franchise has like 4 sequels. And I completely understand after having watched it why this movie is a classic. And so I think it's a great watch during the scary season. And, you know, shout out to Neve Campbell and Courtney Cox and Drew Barrymore for being leading ladies in horror. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Do you mind if I do a couple touches on your comments?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, like, as you kept talking about, Dewey, as a person who might be mentally handicapped, you mentioned watching Scary Movie, and that was exasperated in yes. Scary Movie mm-hmm. as opposed to Scream. So I'm curious if that any play in your mind, which is for you to think about. I do love this movie. I think it did revitalize horror. I think it's amazing. So we were supposed to start this in October, I think, for Halloween, which makes so much more sense. I love that this is coming out in September for Women's History Month.
I do want to point out that it is interesting that you suggested that my thought mm-hmm. about Dewey's abilities might be informed by Scary Movie. I hadn't thought about that, but I do think that his depiction kind of toes the line a little bit. It's open to interpretation, and I think you and I are just kind of on different ends of what, you know, they were trying to get at with his character. So I think that is a really interesting point. So yeah, next up, we got to talk about the ratings a little bit. Over at Rotten Tomatoes, Scream received a critic score of 81%, while the audience gave it 80%.
Ooh, I think
Beth,
that's
what do you think about these ratings?
I'm actually surprised a little bit that the critics gave a higher score than the viewership. But yeah, 80 sounds solid for what it is. I would give it a 95 personally, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with it.
Okay, cool. I feel like I would give it about an 85. Like, it was technically my first time watching, so there are things that I couldn't fully appreciate, I guess because I was stopping to take notes. So, you know, my viewing experience was quite different, right? And also because I spent most of the movie being super suspicious of Dewey, right? So the end actually felt like a real yeah. twist to me, and I was pleasantly surprised to find out who the culprits were and why at the end. So I was happy to see a kind of happy ending and that the killers got their just desserts. So I'm into it. I'll watch it again.
Okay. I love it. Can I ask you like an ending author question?
Sure.
When you watch a whodunit kind of movie, do you try to figure out who's done it, or do
Hell
you?
Yeah.
Do you? Okay.
So I love whodunits. Uh-huh. I love a good whodunit yep. movie. And I always am like, huh, who is it? At the end, it's never to the point where I'm like disappointed if I get it wrong mm-hmm. or anything like that. It's just like a little fun guessing game, right? You know?
Yeah. So I'm the opposite, is I purposely don't. So like you think of like The Sixth Sense. I'm like, I think I know the twist. I don't want to know what it is. I just want to like enjoy it. Mm-hmm. There is some part of me though, where like murder mysteries, try to figure out whodunit, but.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting for kind of saving it for the end. For me, I'm like, nah, it's probably this person. It's probably that person. Oh, snap. He got stabbed in the back, so it wasn't him. You know.
Oh, poor Dewey.
Yeah. I love a good whodunit. Dewey is a survivor, okay? But
no, wait till you watch Scream 5. Like, come on.
Oh, Jesus. I don't know if I'm going to get there. I don't
Please
know.
Please don't. You don't need to. Okay, so real quick, before we end, the Scream trilogy was supposed to be a trilogy. That's how it was pitched. It was amazing. Scream 2 and 3 are not great. Although Scream 3 has been the 2 has Patrick Dempsey in it. Like, you should watch it. It's wildly entertaining. They're both pretty good. Scream 4, you can't have a fourth in a trilogy. So just stop. But was surprisingly adequate. I was actually pleasantly surprised by that one. Scream 5, that movie should burn in fire. Like, I hate it in the bones of my, like, core. And that is my rant. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, you heard it here from a Scream lover and also a first-time watcher. So, what varying. We got very opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to, you know, experience with this movie. So, yeah, thank you all so much for listening to our review of Scream from 1996 here at Submedia Reviews. I want to say a special thanks to Beth for joining me today. Did you have a good time, Beth?
Thank you so much for having me. Like, I'm honestly honored that you asked me to join and hope I did you justice.
Yeah, so many amazing thoughts and added a lot of color to the discussion. So thank you again for being our special guest today. Now, if you're listening, let me know what you think about this movie. Does it hold up for you? Did you rewatch it recently? Share your thoughts with us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Next week, we'll be continuing our Women's History Month series with a review of the 1998 Disney film, The Parent Trap, featuring Lindsay Lohan. What? You don't want to miss it.
Yes.
Peace out.
Thanks for listening to Sub Media Reviews. I hope you enjoyed our trip down memory lane just as much as I did. If you have any suggestions for movies or TV shows you'd like me to review next, or if you just want to share your thoughts on today's episode,
you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest at Sub Media Reviews
and on submediareviews.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps me improve the show and spread the word to new listeners. So until next time, peace out, home slices.